Production. Recorded live.
Right, thanks for joining us again. This is the Avoiding the Drop Dropcast. I'm Jack. I'm on today with Mike Georgia and the Fuse Project. Since Fuse wasn't on last week, Fuse, you want to just say hello to everybody so they can hear your voice?
Hello, everyone. Good to be aboard.
Okay, so what we thought we would start with is MLS playoffs this week. in looking at the schedule, we've got tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2, the Columbus Crew at the Colorado Rapids. Now, you know, I know a lot of people feel like, specifically with Colorado, that they're playing in their stadium is a real advantage because of the thin air. And Columbus is one of the better traveling sides in the league. So, I mean, I sort of feel like this one could go realistically any way. How do you guys feel about this particular matchup? Any thoughts surrounding this one?
Well, I thought I had read earlier in the day that Colorado is the only team in the league who has an overall losing record at home in the playoffs. I could be wrong about that. It could have been another team, but I could have sworn it was when I was reading something about it, because I think I was reading the actual preview on the website about it, on MLS.com about it. Maybe that advantage hasn't exactly been that big in the past, but I think the bigger issue might be the fact that this is the first time they've been in the playoffs in several years, so.
Yeah, I see this being kind of a wash. I mean, there's definitely the altitude advantage that they gain, but I also think Columbus is a team that can move the ball around and let it do the work. And I think if they do that, if they keep it on the deck and let it sort of nullify the running that they might have to do, it's going to come down to talent after that. And I think Columbus probably edges it. That may mean a draw and a win in the return leg, but I think they'll take it.
Yeah, I sort of felt, just from the experience of watching these two teams play against the Union, and that's unfortunately my frame of reference this year, because I didn't actually see that many matches on TV as opposed to seeing as many as I did at PPL. But basically what I felt, you know, Columbus to me is one of those sides who really have a lot of belief in themselves, and they definitely believe that no lead is safe, so that even if Colorado were to get out to an early lead, I sort of feel like Columbus has a bit of a never say die attitude, and I feel like they have that second leg at home. I just feel like they're the ones to advance from this one, and I'm sorry that Adam isn't on the call, because I'm sure he would definitely have some thoughts about Colorado around that. But I think that this is the four first round matchups are really, really solid ones. So the next one to talk about is on the 30th, which is Saturday, 5 p.m. on Fox Soccer Channel, which is Real Salt Lake at FC Dallas in the first leg of that one. I know for me, I feel like Dallas may be a bit over their heads with this one. I feel like RSL got a lot of playoff experience last year, obviously winning the title, and certainly have a deep squad. And I'm not sure how you guys feel about that. Am I barking up the wrong tree there? Do you feel like Dallas may have a shot?
I think that it's going to be pretty evenly matched, actually. I think that they do have a shot just based on past games this season. I mean, you know, Dallas had their 19-game unbeaten run, and it ended with a 2-0 loss to Salt Lake. And then the last time Real Salt Lake lost was when they played against Dallas. So they've beaten each other this year, and they're both very hard teams to beat. I think they each only had 4 or 5 losses. And, you know, obviously Dallas has had more draws than wins, but I think this is going to be the closest affair. I think Salt Lake will take it, but I think it's going to be the cagiest one and the definitely the tightest one. It could be 1-1 and then and maybe 1-1 in both leg, and then Salt Lake takes it in the second leg. But it might not be the most exciting one, but I think it'll be the most competitive.
Yeah, I hate to sort of reduce it down to two players, but for me it just comes down to goalkeeping in this one. And I guess I'm of two minds. First, I've never really been a big believer in Dario Sala if he's the one who gets the start. He seems prone to just the sort of mental lapses. And then at the other end, you know, you've got Nick Raimondo, who, you know, he's too short, he's too this, he's too that, and yet he's won everywhere he's gone. He won last year in a very big way in the shootout. And I think it's just going to come down to, you know, which team can keep their head. And I think when you've got leadership like that at the back, that's going to make a big difference.
I agree with that. I think those two definitely will play a big part in it. And I was actually, I don't know if you saw this or not, but when the list was released today of the nominees for the MLS Year-End Awards, David Ferreira from Dallas was actually nominated as one of the three MVP finalists, along with Edson Buttle and Chris Wondolowski from San Jose, who we'll be talking about in a minute. But there was a lot of feeling, of course, around here that Sebastian Letou should be nominated, and the fact that David Ferreira was nominated led me to go look at his numbers, because I certainly felt as if I wasn't aware of what he had done to be nominated over Letou, and he's obviously had a very good season. So I think Dallas definitely can put up a fight. I mean, the only time that we saw them here was second match of the season for the Union at Lincoln Financial Field, and they certainly did not put on a good performance that day. But I think they were still sort of gathering steam at that point. But it should be a very interesting one. And, you know, I looked at the thread to see what everybody was predicting for the next one, which is the New York Red Bull at San Jose Earthquakes, which is Saturday night, 10 p.m. on Telefutura. And I was a little bit shocked to see everybody picking San Jose, because, I mean, I thought they were quite organized and they looked quite good in terms of keeping their shape and playing in a very, you know, clean and crisp fashion. And I certainly like Wondolowski had a great season. I was just shocked to see everybody picking them. And I know, I guess, traveling across the country, and I get the factors involved there, and, you know, it's much easier to pick the home teams in this first leg, but I just was shocked to see so many people picking San Jose in this match. Thoughts from you guys on that?
I actually think that I think New York is going to win the tie, but I think that this game is actually going to be a draw, just because I'm not sure with Henri being out. As last I heard, he was not playing the first leg, so it's going to fall to Juan Pablo, and I think that they'll be able to score, but I just think the combination of Wondolowski and Giovanni is going to be too much to completely shut down. I mean, Giovanni just opens up that midfield opens up the attack, and I think that they're just going to have to I think it's going to be maybe a 2-2 game, and then I think New York's going to win the home leg or the return leg. But I don't know. San Jose they only had a +1 goal differential in the year, so I got a good feeling this one's going to be close. But I think New York's going to take the tie overall.
I actually have San Jose going all the way to the final, and we'll see how that makes me look in a couple of weeks. But I think for a couple of reasons. The most obvious one is that I hate the Red Bulls, so we'll start with that. but in terms of actual action on the field, I think a couple things. Wondolowski is, I think, emblematic of the team. He's getting hotter as the season goes on, and they've sort of done the same thing. They've built momentum toward the playoffs, and that's always a good sign. Second, I think Bobby Convy is sort of very quietly coming back to the player he was before he left for Reading. Not there yet, but he's definitely working that midfield role like he used to. And then I think also, I think the Red Bulls are a year away. I mean, I know they're going to lose Angel. They'll probably pick somebody else up, but I just don't think with Henri being out so much, and as you said, probably still being out, I don't think they've ever had a chance to throw everything together. And while you know, guys like Dane Richards and others have stepped up. Tim Ream, Lynn Pair looks like a great player. I think they just need one more year to put it together. I expect they'll be very good next year, but I don't think they're going to make it this year.
Yeah, they they certainly did not look good when they played at PPL at the end of the season. They actually were outplayed tremendously, and I'm talking about the Red Bulls, especially in the first 45. They just looked disorganized. They did look defensively deficient. And, you know, I essentially looked to me like the squad that they would have out, you know, in a potential playoff game. And I thought to myself, you know, I guess they had really piled up the points at the beginning of the season and certainly gotten, you know, a healthy number, you know, towards the Eastern Conference. And it just seemed to me that they just, I don't know if they thought about potential playoff positioning in that match or not, but they certainly did not look the part to me in that, and especially in the first 45. They played a little bit better in the second half. They pressed a little bit more, but there was some interesting byplay, especially in the midfield, that I just found a bit baffling, because certainly one thing about the Union was if you got through the midfield, you certainly could get shots off, and they seem to have trouble generating shots at times. I think, you know, I sort of feel like Georgia does. I mean, I don't necessarily know whether or not it's a sort of an East Coast bias thing to always sort of think, oh, it's a West Coast team, and, you know, the Red Bulls, and they have Henri, and they have Angel, and all these other names. I don't really know, but I sort of feel like the Red Bulls would be my pick, but I don't know that it would be a strong feeling for me anyway. And then finally, the other West Coast matchup, the Super Club, the New York Cosmos, the Barcelona, the Real Madrid, the AC Milan of the United States, the Los Angeles Galaxy at the Seattle Sounders in that cavernous football stadium, 35,000 screaming, insane, green-wearing fans for the Seattle Sounders. It's Halloween night, Sunday night, 8 p.m. on ESPN2. David Beckham, Landon Donovan, etc., against Freddie Montero and his crew. That should be quite tasty.
Yeah, I think that's going to be... I mean, at the beginning of the season, I picked Seattle to win the Cup, and I have to stick by that. But this, to me, is definitely the, and I guess to the league too, the sexiest matchup. You know, I had Montero winning the Golden Boot, but yeah, that did not exactly play out. But he obviously still has goal scoring ability. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that whoever comes out of this game, I think this is the best team in the West. So, and. You know, I got to stick with it. I think Seattle wins both games.
I think they may take this one, but I would say I'm with the Galaxy for the tie. I think the Sounders have proved they can play with anybody, but they've also proven that they can lay an egg on occasion. I think though the atmosphere, you know, if the Galaxy can get out of this with a 1-1 draw, I think they'll take it pretty easily when they go back to the Home Depot Center. I think, you know, everyone will be psyched up for this match, but after that, there'll be a little withdrawal. And I think overall, the Galaxy are just a little more tight-knit and sound team. I don't know if that's because Beckham has finally decided that he's not going to be the star that I think he thought he was going to be over here, or whether the rest of the players have sort of stepped up a little closer to his level. But either way, I think the Galaxy will win it in the end.
I am going to pick the Seattle Sounders to win this tie. I believe that the Galaxy will be the big disappointment this year in the MLS playoffs. And I certainly think that they are a fine squad. They certainly have enough quality players, but I just have a feeling that Seattle is going to upset them, and I think they will be the disappointment this year. So I guess we'll see. That's the nice thing about these playoffs. It's eight fairly good squads, all things considered. You know, should be quite interesting to see how this turns out. And just for everybody's informational purposes, the second legs San Jose, New York, second leg is November 4th, 8 p.m. Colorado at Columbus, the second leg is November 6th at 4 p.m. Later that night, Dallas at Real Salt Lake at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And the second leg for Seattle and the Galaxy is November 7th, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. So that should cover the first round, and we can perhaps talk about the second legs next week if we get a chance to. Anything more on those MLS playoffs before we move on?
Not for me.
Nope.
Okay, next thing we wanted to talk about was the Ballon d'Or list that came out the other day for the, you know, that very prestigious World Player of the Year, I guess, award, however you want to term it at this point. And it's quite a list of players who've been nominated. We had an article on the site about it the other day. Mags went through it, and obviously, from my point of view, sort of a shame, I thought, that it was so Spanish-heavy. But when you look at how the nominations are put together, obviously, Spain had a fantastic year in terms of both their two top clubs and their national team. You know, obviously, there's a fair amount of representation from the Dutch side as well, and they had several high-profile players go a long, long way in the Champions League and do very well at the club seasons. So you can sort of understand the list, but I thought basically what I wanted to ask you guys first was, how did you feel about Cesc Fabregas being on the list while Wayne Rooney, and I know all of the thoughts around Wayne Rooney not scoring much lately and not doing hardly anything in the World Cup, but had a fantastic club season last year. I'm a little surprised that Fabregas made it and Rooney did not. Any thoughts on that? And then just go on and talk about the rest of the list if you'd like.
I thought that, I mean, honestly, just based on the fact that they focused so much on the World Cup, I think that they both had outstanding enough club seasons to justify it. I don't really think you could say Fabregas's World Cup was much better than Rooney's, but as far as his contributions go. But I mean, he did play some role, but you know, they did. I think I'm not trying to take that away from him, but I think he's as worthy as Alonso being on the list. But I was more surprised to see Drogba on there, but not see Rooney than a comparison between Fabregas and Rooney.
Yeah, it looks, just looking at the list, it seems to me that the selectors want to have it both ways. You know, they want to nominate some guys for their World Cup performance. Klose comes to mind, or even Gyan. And then others for what they did during their club seasons. And I guess on that basis, you can sort of, you know, you can justify making this list probably twice as long if you wanted to. You know, there's no Rooney, but there is Drogba, and apparently those are both, you know, based on, you would think anyway, their club work. But then, you know, you get someone like I said, like Klose. And, you know, what did he do outside of the World Cup? Pretty much
nothing. He got benched for Thomas Mueller.
Yeah.
I mean, it, you know, he scored the goal in the Champions League against, I think against, yeah, Fiorentina, that was 3 yards offside and was the winning goal in the tie, and or in that game. And, yeah, he had no reason to be there. I mean, Mueller has a better case overall. I mean, he had a very good World Cup when he played. And, you know, he close obviously scored more goals, but Mueller had a pretty good season with Bayern. I mean, he was one of their better players in their Champions League run. So I think I'm okay with him being on there. I was a little surprised to see Julio Cesar on there. But, you know, again, Inter winning, I guess that's just strictly a product of their, of the treble win. So, you know, but other than that, I mean, the ones that are the biggest, I mean, Klose at least he had, I mean, he had a very good World Cup, but Asamoah Gyan, that one to me, I mean, I don't get that one at all. I mean, I know he was big for Ghana, but I don't even think he really played last season in domestic. So that one kind of irritated me a bit, but I guess they wanted to try and get good representation from everywhere. But at the same time, they have several African players, but they have no Asian players. And based on league performance and World Cup, I think you could have put Keisuke Honda on there based on the amount of goals he scored in Holland, then started scoring in Russia, and then he had a very good tournament for Japan. So I kind of thought that was a shocking omission based on the fact that they like to make people happy from regions.
Yeah, I'll tell you a name who who I was actually a bit surprised to see on there, and that is Cristiano Ronaldo. I really felt as if Cristiano Ronaldo's season last year was not up to snuff. I felt like he missed a fair amount of time for Real Madrid. I felt like he did not give great effort for Portugal, and I feel like that was just strictly because his name is Cristiano Ronaldo that he was put on that list. I'm a bit shocked at that one.
Well, to be fair, he did score. I mean, he scored 26 league goals in 29 league games. So, I mean, he did have a – he did I was looking at the same thing. I mean, it was basically like he didn't win anything, and his club had a disastrous Champions League. But it almost – it was kind of – but I guess that they have to be basing it on his performance for Madrid in the league. That's really his only thing.
I don't necessarily have a problem with that. But I mean, you know, the one thing that always strikes me about him is, you know, there's always the talk about what kind of goals do people score, and you know, when you look at certain people's goal-scoring records, and you're like, oh, well, such-and-such put up this many goals or what have you. I mean, I always try to look at the statistic that says how many game-winning goals did this person have, or how many, you know, how were those goals achieved? And, you know, to just put up a big number, yeah, it's fine. And to a certain extent, I think there's an argument can be made that Darren Bent had a better club season last year than Wayne Rooney did based on game-winning goals, et cetera. But be that as it may, I'm not necessarily having a go at Cristiano Ronaldo as a player, you know, last year's club season, what have you. But if, I mean, what exactly is the criteria to get on this list? Because I mean, if it's a great, you know, World Cup like Diego Forlan had, I mean, that's clearly, you know, you guys have mentioned him, Asamoah Gyan, Closer, you know, getting on this list based on the World Cup. And then you look at guys like Wesley Schneider, who, well, he's a bad example because he had a decent World Cup. But you look at a guy like Mesut Ozil. I mean, Werder Bremen didn't do that much in the league last year. He's on there because he had a great World Cup. So I'm not exactly sure what the criteria is because, you know, for all intents and purposes, Ronaldo did not do very much for Portugal as a player. And certainly, you know, yeah, he scored a lot of goals for Real Madrid. But how many of them were game winners and how many of them did he get in the Champions League where they got bounced out again in the round of 16? That's all I'm saying. I mean, I don't have a problem with him as a player. I find his inclusion on this list.
He had those goals. I don't think anybody would argue that the season he had for Madrid was anything close to his last few. I mean, his last two seasons with Manchester. He was the guy who always came up and got the late winning goal for Manchester and wasn't always for Madrid. And a lot of I don't remember how many, but I know for sure his first goal was a penalty, but I think a few of them were from the spot. But you know, I think Snyder or Forlan should win. I mean, Forlan had an outstanding World Cup, but he also had a good, he scored 18 goals in La Liga again. I mean, he was, you know, European Golden Shoe winner the previous year. But you know, I think Snyder getting to the final, winning the treble with Inter, I think that I really, you know, it probably would go to a Spain player, but I honestly don't think any of those Spanish player seasons were more impressive than Snyder's, even though they won the World Cup. So I hope it goes to him, but it'll probably go to Xavi.
Yeah, it's hard to say, you know, what the nominations are based on, or really, you know, what the voting criteria should be, because, you know, if you want to look at, you know, who won the most, all right, that's one guy. If you want to look at who was just out and out the best player of the year, that could be another guy. If you want to look at who was the most important player to their club or country, that could be a third guy. And I kind of, I guess, maybe lean towards what Georgia was saying with Forlan. You know, I put in my comment to the actual post that if you look at the 2009-2010 domestic season and then add the World Cup in, that's 33 goals in 63 matches. And, you know, for me, a goal every two matches is pretty much the mark of a pretty impressive striker, and he did it in a great league, and then he did it in the biggest tournament there is. So,
and he didn't do it with guys like Kaká or Messi behind him either. I mean, he wasn't playing on a bad team by any means. I mean, he still had a very good team behind him, but it was still on a different tier of level of talent.
Right.
So I think whether
it was Madrid, you know, Atletico, or Uruguay, yeah, he's not only creating his own shot, but I think if you watch the World Cup, you know, he's picking everybody up who's around him. You know, those are good players.
And speaking of Uruguay, who else could have been put on here easily would have been Luis Suarez.
Yes, he was excellent.
Maybe he's not on there because of that handball, but he had, you know, I know, obviously, disclaimer, it was in Holland, but he still had another fantastic season. He had 35 goals in 33 games in the league, 49 and 48 overall. And then he had I don't remember how many goals he had in the World Cup, but I know he had, I think at least, I know he scored both against South Korea, and I think he scored a few more. And he played a big part in getting them past Ghana. So I kind of thought that he certainly deserved to be on there as well. But, you know, I guess that's what happens when you play in Holland, maybe.
Yeah, I would get behind Forlan, absolutely. I like Wesley Schneider, you know, certainly I agree definitely with the Luis Suarez point. I thought he was brilliant in the World Cup. Uruguay was actually, I got to see a lot of the World Cup, and Uruguay, you know, really did put on quite a show, and they impressed me tremendously. And I thought that when you look at what Forlan was able to do and the kind of goals he was able to generate and the kind of interest I think he specifically generated for the average fan who was watching those matches, who may not have, you know, a vested interest in the game the way that we do. I think he was approachable, and I thought, you know, he definitely looked the part of a guy who, you know, is a really fantastic player. And I would imagine a lot of people's perceptions of Uruguay as a country would be that, you know, when you think of the average person watching that tournament, they think of Brazil, they think of Argentina, they think of Germany, they think of, you know, Italy. And, you know, so Uruguay coming out of the blue and basically, you know, sort of making a run, he certainly, I think, earned to be mentioned at the top of this list. So it's an interesting list, you know, it always is. And then they come up with these names and you're not quite sure how. And so, you know, we were talking about Wayne Rooney, and one of the things we sort of broached on last week in the topic that we were talking about with Rooney was money. And one of the things that I said was specific to the new UEFA financial rules was that, you know, if you think about it, and now that this has played itself out and we've got a contract and he's signed and supposedly it's somewhere between 200 and 250,000 pounds a week, you know, you guys have certainly looked at all the finances for United specific to the amount of debt they carry versus their turnover, et cetera. And so what I wanted to ask you guys was, you know, with the way the rules are laid out now, you've got to worry about the homegrown rule. You've got to worry about the squad of 25 that you must name. And I'm specifically talking about the Premier League now. You've got to worry about these UEFA fair play financial rules. And you've got to obviously be able to put a product on the field that is going to be able to maintain, you know, a Champions League level. This is something I was talking about with a pal of mine who's a Spurs supporter the other day. You know, when you look at the top of the league now, you've got these five clubs, you know, essentially, in my opinion, now sort of fighting for four spots in United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester City, and Spurs. And so it's you know, it's difficult to sort of manage the finances and get all that together. But specific to Rooney, the contract that he signed, if it's £250,000 a week, once these UEFA Fair Play financial rules come in, I mean, how on earth are they going to be able to sort of fit all this in and still maintain this squad? I mean, that's the question that I have. I'll let you guys talk about it.
They're not going to be able to. I mean, I think that, I mean, but yeah, also at the same time, they're going to have Giggs, Scholes, Van der Sar, Neville, possibly, and maybe by that point, maybe Carrick will be gone. I mean, they're going to be shedding a lot of contract space there. But what's going to be interesting is, like, they're always going to have to give Rooney a lot of money if he was going to stay. But what'll be interesting to see is what level of player they go after in the next few transfer windows. Because if they're going after guys like Wesley Snyder, then they are going to be in big trouble. As far as, you know, that's going to be taking up two player spaces with one player as far as contract value goes. But if they go after people like Steven Defour out of Belgium, who are still going to cost a little bit, but won't be demanding outrageous wages because they're younger and not proven in top leagues yet. So that'll be what we see, which direction they're going to go. But at the time, I mean, I don't see how they're going to be able to fit everyone in there, especially not if they keep going after big players. But when they came out today and Snyder signed his new contract, everyone says that ended speculation. It won't end the speculation. It just means that now Inter have a lot more leverage with him if he does end up wanting to move at some point. But I don't think, given these rules, I don't see how United can handle another contract like that.
Yeah, I think my main issue with all of this is that I don't trust a word that comes out of any club's mouth as to what their real finances are. And so you're always going on what they're giving you for information. And because of that, it doesn't really matter what FIFA or UEFA or anybody else makes for rules. You know, if they're making their rules on one set of information that turns out not to be real, then the whole thing is going to come crashing down, which frankly I think is going to happen anyway. I don't think there is enough money out there to sustain this anymore. And, you know, there's clubs that have survived by being feeder clubs. The problem is we're in a situation now where there's not going to be any buyer clubs anymore. You know, so you're going to have, you know, United, which may have Rooney, maybe two or three other people, not quite on that pay grade, but around that, and then trying to fill the spaces with younger, cheaper, or, you know, the equivalent of the aging baseball free agent that you might get one or two seasons out of before he retires or moves on. And there's not going to be any way to change that because there's nobody to sell a Wayne Rooney to. You know, if you're just selling him to a club that is in financial situation that's just as bad, you know, it's just sort of this carousel. And eventually it's going to come to a stop. And I think, you know, the edges have already started to fray. You see clubs like Portsmouth, who not only were relegated, they barely stayed in existence about a week or so ago. Unless there's some sort of transparency from the clubs, I don't think it really matters. I think it's just going to be a lot of talk and a lot of posturing that is still going to end up with a lot of clubs in deep financial trouble.
Yeah, I don't really. I think, like, I was just going to say that I think, who are the clubs who are the most forthcoming with their financial information? I mean, I would have to think that Arsenal would probably be the most forthcoming, just based on the stuff they've been publishing in the last few years. But I don't really see that stuff from everyone else, or maybe it just doesn't get the immediate attention. But yeah, I don't particularly trust anyone at this point after what I've seen happen personally in the last few years. So
yeah, I think the only time you see the truth, and it still takes some digging, is when a club gets into a situation like Portsmouth, where they, in order to survive, have to admit what's actually going on. And until that point, I think, you know, teams are going to try to just paper things over it and hope they can pull themselves out of it. But I'm not sure there's a route to do that for most clubs.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's going to be a meltdown somewhere. And I'm not quite sure where it's going to be. You know, the thing is, when you look at what happened, and Mike, I don't want to bring up a sore subject for you, but when you look at what happened with Liverpool, you know, I think basically when you consider how the Boston Red Sox operate and you consider how statistically oriented they are, and you consider that they are very much interested in finding players who fit a certain set of criteria. I mean, I don't know how much of that will apply in soccer or football, whatever you want to call it. But I think that there's a certain sense that that may be coming in terms of, instead of just saying, you know, I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy the biggest name I can think of, or I'm going to buy, we need a defenseman, so I'm going to go buy, I'm going to, you know, make it known that we want Mike on, or we want whomever, Carlos Puyol, whoever. I think you may see a bit more statistical evidence that a player is worth X amount of dollars because of this performance. I think that may be coming, but I'm not exactly sure when it may happen. The thing is, I cannot see how, for the life of me, some of these clubs are going to be able to fulfill these UEFA rules. Now, that being said, you know, UEFA always says, oh, the sky is falling. We're about to bring the hammer down on all these clubs for all their wrongdoing. And then the next thing you know, it's, oh, you know, they were actually within the rules, such as they are, as murky as they are, and everything's fine. I mean, I was shocked. I mean, I guess I shouldn't have been, but I was shocked when Chelsea got out of that transfer ban. I couldn't believe it. I mean, if you're going to make a rule, then you need to enforce the rule. And I wonder about these financial rules, whether or not they're actually going to say, okay, Chelsea, Roman Abramovich, one of the biggest clubs in the world, you sell more merchandise than anybody else. You're not in the Champions League this year because you cannot prove to us that you're making that you're financially solvent. Are they really going to do that? I mean, maybe they will, and maybe this Rooney thing will be the last of the big salaries. I don't know. And as I said last week, I have a feeling that him and his agent may have seen. I don't know if I'm giving Wayne Rooney way too much credit for something like this, but I mean, you know, maybe they saw this coming. Maybe they saw the idea that, you know, United are not going to be able to pay a certain, you know, certain salaries over the next few years. Maybe they saw the idea that, you know, like Mike pointed out, that Giggs, Scholes, Van der Sar, Gary Neville going to be retiring, going to be moving on, not those salaries come off the books. Now, maybe, I don't know, but I, for the life of me, I just don't see how this is going to be sustained. I cannot imagine how Manchester City specifically are going to be able to do this. They have so many long contracts. Now, obviously, if Tevez leaves, maybe that will work itself out a little bit for them money-wise, but they've got some incredible contracts for a long period of time. I'm not sure how they're going to be able to be admitted to the Champions League if UEFA actually wants to enforce these rules. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say that when you were saying you didn't know if they'll actually bring the hammer down on anyone, I don't think they'll bring the hammer down on someone like Madrid, Barcelona, Chelsea, Milan, any of those guys. But the fact that if City do break into the Champions League within the next 2 years, they're going to be the ones that it's going to be an issue for them. And I think that they're going to, they're not as established in Europe at all. So I think that if they wanted to make an example of someone, they would have the opportunity to do it with them. So, but I don't think they will, because I think they're all the organization has absolutely no backbone. So,
yeah, if I can get back to the Red Sox comment and maybe give a little ray of sunshine here. The other thing the Red Sox have been really good at doing is, as you said, identifying the traits they want in their players, and then identifying those players early in their own system and bringing them along towards those goals. And I think, you know, if that approach is taken in football, we actually might see a return to a lot more homegrown players. You know, right now for the big clubs, it's kind of a smorgasbord. You need something, you go get it. You pay whatever it takes to get it. And obviously, I think we all agree, that's going to have to come to an end, whether people like it or not. It can't remain standing. But, you know, that may mean sort of a return to the way things were once done, where, you know, you sign a kid young, you teach him to play the game the way you want it played, to emphasize the points you want in terms of what a successful player is for your club, and you bring them along. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But by and large, as has been the case with the Red Sox, you know, you're going to get, over time, a good haul of players who can do the things you want them to do and make you successful in that way.
Yeah, and I actually think that's when people were describing NSV's strategy this week, and by this week I mean using quotes from last week but running it this week because Liverpool won a game, so they had to run a negative story. Not that I'm bitter about this, but the strategy, I think it mirrors what Arsenal have been doing. They have made some signings, but they still don't make the big signings, and they make smart signings, and they bring up, you know, they develop players, but they also are good at identifying young players from other countries and getting them. And I actually would have no problem with them running that kind of system. I think that's great, especially since Liverpool already have brought in several top rated prospects in the last year. So, you know, I think I personally think it would be great. And I'm tired of guys being bought and then completely, like, with no real position. It's like, the guy can play anywhere in the midfield. Like, great, that means he doesn't really have a position, and he's not spectacular at anything, but competent at everything. It's like, it needs to be more specialized, I think. So, I don't know, I think it's going to be, it'll be an era that I'm more than welcome to see.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what happens for Liverpool over the next couple of years. It's going to be very interesting to see how that turns out. Last thing before we go, we wanted to talk a bit about Scotland since we have Fuse with us and he is expert on all things Scotland. I guess wanted to start with, you have news on Dundee, but I also wanted to talk about the Old Firm matchup. I know how much you love those two clubs. You hold them so dear in your heart, and all the shenanigans that happened at the end of the match last week, death threats to the referee, and I guess the question is that match and is that league, are those stories, is that a big deal in the world of soccer, or is it just a big deal in Scotland?
I guess it's both, which is a nice way of not answering your question. I think in Scotland, obviously, it's the two biggest teams. It's the biggest game of the year every time it's played. I guess the interesting thing as far as the actual match goes is that the talk before the match was basically about the referee and not about the players and the action itself. I listen to the BBC Scotland podcast pretty much daily, and what they were basically wishing, I guess, for the referee was not to screw up. He was a young guy, his first Old Firm match, and he promptly went out and did that. I don't want to call it a comedy of errors or anything like that, but I think because they're the only two teams that really matter beyond the country's borders at this point, that it even magnifies things more. So, you know, was it important? Sure, if you support one of those two clubs. Is it important, you know, beyond Scotland? Not really. I just think, you know, I've been against it for a long time, and I mentioned in a comment to a post a few days ago, you know, I'm ready for both teams to go. Partly because I don't like them and sort of all the nonsense that goes on around them. But also partly because, you know, how exciting can a league be where every other team below the first two in the entire quasi-pyramid they have in Scotland, you know, is playing for third place? You know, it's great to have a dominant team for a while. I think a lot of other sports have shown that, whether it's, you know, Steelers or Patriots in football, or the Red Sox or the Yankees or the Bruins or, you know, the Oilers back in the Gretzky day, whatever. It's great to have the dynasty. But when those two dynasties are winning, you know, 75 of every 80 championships, it's just not interesting if you're not a fan of one of those two teams.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there's been a lot of difficulties over the past few years with Scotland, and the reputation of the club league, I think, has taken a major, major hit with some of their performances, some of Rangers and Celtic's performances in the Champions League and not performing up to snuff. But obviously that goes back into the idea of what happened with Setanta Sports and how that television network falling apart basically almost killed that league. But obviously I think, you know, anytime that derby happens and a referee causes that kind of problem, I just think it's a story that people are going to hear about, and I think it's a story that people are going to go, well, it's Celtic and Rangers, and this is what goes on. But, you know, I wonder about the long-term viability of that league. And when you said that the other day, I hadn't really thought about the idea of them leaving for quite some time. But, I mean, in terms of how Scotland looks now, I mean, if they were to leave, I mean, you start to wonder then, you know, would that league actually improve? I mean, so if you go from 12 to 10 and then say you add, you know, say you promote, I don't know, or maybe combine the top division with the second division for a larger league, play more fixtures, you know, establish new rivalries, maybe some longstanding teams, you know, find some legs again. I don't see that as a horrible idea. I just don't know what you do with Celtic and Rangers at that point, because the Premier League has said no on numerous occasions, and I don't know how that would work.
Put them in the Championship with no possibility of promotion, like Real Madrid B and Barcelona B. Just if they want to come to England, let them play in the Championship, and they can't get in the Champions League. But if they want to get in the Europa League, they just have to win the FA Cup, and everyone wins except for those two teams. But you know, that's their fault.
Yeah,
that's my solution.
Yeah, whatever happens, I think unfortunately it's going to be financially motivated. But to get back to what you were saying, I mean, there's already talk of adding two teams to the SPL as soon as next season, great. So there's two more teams that won't win. I don't see the point in that, other than bringing some money to those two teams because they get to play, you know, the Old Firm twice a year, which would be great for them, the smaller teams, from a cash standpoint. I tend to think it would be a situation where over time other teams will get their chances. You know, they'll probably get one Champions League spot and one Europa League spot, maybe, or maybe just one European spot overall. But there'll be competition for it. There'll be European exposure for those teams, a chance to maybe to get a little better. And I hate to be sort of pessimist, fatalist, cynic, whatever you want to call it, but things can't be much worse. You know, right now you have a two-team league, and wherever they go and under whatever circumstances, I can't think what they leave behind could really be any different, because as it is right now, it's a logjam. It's Rangers and Celtic and everyone else. And if they're gone, at least everyone else has, you know, something to look up towards, as opposed to let's just not get relegated.
Well, would you have any solution for where they could go?
I think the idea of a North Atlantic League is dead and probably should be, quite frankly. As far as going into the English pyramid, well, there's non-English teams already in the pyramid. And I think if they did go in, I think probably, you know, if it was up to me, you place them in the championship, and then you let them fend for themselves. If they can move themselves up, good for them. If they drop down and end up in League One or League Two, well, you know, that's the chance they take. I think in any other country, political union, whatever you want to call it, there's really nothing you can do. But since there's already the precedent of Cardiff and other teams, and even English teams playing in the Scottish League, you know, that door's been open, so push them through it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. Give us the news on Dundee, and then we've probably got to wrap this up.
All right, just very quickly, they went into administration for the second time in 4 years about a month ago, and today their administrator, Brian Jackson, met with the SFA to see what was going to be their fate. The decision is going to come out Monday, most likely. It could be anything from a 10-point deduction, which they might be able to survive and stay up, to a 25-point deduction, which would essentially relegate them. But here's the thing. The Scottish Football Association has a rule built in that basically gives them the ability to do whatever they want to. They can shut the club down. They can not penalize it. They can deduct points. They can drop it divisions, whatever they want to. Now, there's that, but there's also the fact that there's precedent. Livingston FC went into administration twice, 2004, 2009, and their punishment was to be dropped from the first to the third division. Basically, they were told, you can take that as your medicine, or we can shut you down and you're gone. So I think if they don't do that to Dundee, there's going to be some very angry Livingston supporters who say, you know, we were in the same situation. You dropped us two divisions, made us reorganize ourselves. You know, why is Dundee getting different treatment? But basically, you know, the die has been cast. I mean, the players who were released because they were making too much money have already begun to sign with other clubs. The two guys who were sort of behind the whole problem, Bob Brennan and Callum Melville, it's much the same situation as you saw at Gretna a few years ago, or even now at Hoffenheim with Dietmar Hopp, where they've come in and taken not quite a small club, but taking a club and supported it financially, and then when they pulled the financial rug out from under the team, you know, there's nothing there. So it'll be interesting. We'll know Monday. I'm planning on, in a week or so, doing a sort of an update on my piece from last year about the financial state of the Scottish League in general, and can probably flesh it out there. But, you know, I would say that whatever happens, someone's going to be angry. It's just a case of who and how angry they're going to be.
Well, that all just sounds absolutely delightful.
Yes, it's just a great big mess. I mean, whatever the SFA decides, essentially we'll be wrong.
My goodness, what a mess. Okay, thank you for that. I hadn't caught up with that news, so thank you for the update there. All right, so anything else before we call this one? Boys, Mike, anything from you?
You can I did a guest spot on the unprofessionalfoul.com's podcast, the Foulcast, and that came out yesterday, so you can get that on their website, and I plugged this on there, so there'll be some overlap between listeners, hopefully. So thanks everyone who listened to that. So
I'll sort of tout something of my own too. Tomorrow's weekend preview, there's a lot of big stuff going on this weekend. In Germany, you've got first and second place teams playing and the third and fourth place teams playing. You've got the same thing, first and second playing in Belgium with Genk and Anderlecht, and we'll see if Sasha Kljestan gets to play. Obviously, United and Spurs, big match tomorrow. And same thing in France. You've got first place Reims and second place Marseille playing each other, and third place Brest and fourth place Saint-Étienne playing each other. So in addition to MLS, there's a lot of meaningful stuff going on tomorrow and on the rest of the weekend.
Very nice. Very nice. That's, I'm obviously my chief concerns are Arsenal at 10, Spurs at 12:30. It should be two very interesting matches. Very interested to see what happens with Spurs up at Old Trafford, because they never win there, ever. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how that whole situation plays out. Okay, boys, thank you very much for your time. We'd like to thank our friends at Unprofessional Foul for having Mike on. Those boys are really, really great. If you want a great website to go read, unprofessionalfoul.com, they do a great job there. We'd like to thank them. Obviously, our fellows who couldn't be here today, Adam, Mags, Kevin, we'll get them all on again. Adam on again, and we'll get Mags and Kevin on at some point. So, and we want to thank you, obviously, for listening. We really appreciate all the time that you give us, your clicks, your comments, as usual. We could not do this without you, so we really, really thank you a lot. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your weekends. Thank you.